We're going to call to order the House Ag Policy Committee. We have just a little bit of a difference in the how we're going to lay out the agenda for today. We've got Representative Hamilton will go first. I think then we'll have the honeybee habitat bill, and then we'll have Representative Wills as the last bill before us. But we do have, and we're still waiting. I think we might be at a quorum. Not yet. So we're not. So we're. But if we can. So it is House File 407. So, and Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And after the conversation with the chair, I will make the motion to pass this. And I'll concede without recommendation. And it is going to. Environment, Natural Resources, and Ag Finance. Is that correct?
That is correct. Thank you.
All right. And so,
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And committee members, most of you, or all of us probably, have heard me speak about this before. And my whole line of thinking with this is, we're investing dollars into ag businesses and rural development, as we should. I don't think there's any disagreement on that. One of the areas that, after talking to a number of folks in the ag business arena, is filling up that pipeline of students and young adults that are interested in pursuing agriculture as a profession. And I've said it before, never has there been more opportunity in agriculture as there is today. And so what I was trying to accomplish here, talking to many, many people, is starting with the students, the young 4-H'ers. And if you remember the presentation that I had when we were able to explain different things our district has to offer, it listed all the different programs that the 4-H'ers do in order to get students thrilled about agriculture. And it's not just about production ag or anything like that. It's a whole wide array of different opportunities. And then subsequently roll into FFA and our students there. We've had a tremendous amount of testimony. These are some of the best students the state has to offer. They're intelligent and articulate and very respectful and professional. It's just a wonderful, wonderful program. And then move to the next level, if you will, about investing more dollars into MEALC, where I would like to establish a grant process, a competitive grant program, where if a high school wants to reinstate an ag class and they need some seed money to put that ag teacher on board, and like I said, to reinstate that ag program, where they can turn to MEALC and do that. And then you go to the next level then, the MARL program. Here's your Minnesota Agriculture Rural Leadership Program and the great work that that program has to offer. And we've had people testifying on that. And so, again, it's about getting individuals into the pipeline all the way through to promote agriculture and get them excited about pursuing that as a career. And then I put a few other entities in here, too, that are support functions, if you will, the Center for Rural Policy and Development, Farm America. It's all around ag literacy type activities. And that is the whole drive behind this, the motivation behind this bill initially. And again, we're seeking where can we find funds, right? And the Agri program is a new program. That is a new account. Those are monies that are just going into that. If you think about it, when we had the ethanol producer payments and the deficiency payments, if memory serves me correctly, it was Chairman Al Junkie and Chairwoman Mary Ellen Otrumba at the time that worked with Governor Plenty in establishing that account. And last legislative session, I was honored to be the chair of this committee and Senator Magnus over in the Senate, and we worked very closely together to make sure that we were able to capture the tails. once the program was ended and roll in this account. And once we finished those deficiency payments, about $2.5 million went into the account. And so there were some directives there for the department on putting together a plan and make recommendations back to the legislature on how those dollars would be spent. Now, in my personal opinion, never was it meant to prohibit us from offering up our ideas and suggestions as well. And now we're going to have 10 or up to $20 million into that account. And I think everybody agrees we want to hold on to those dollars in agriculture because we can do more great things. I'm trying to raise the awareness, and there's many people that sign on to the bill, and I thank you for that. Raise the awareness about agriculture education, more awareness about that, and opportunities in agriculture in general. And so that's the motivation behind this bill, Madam Chair. And I don't know if you have any questions or if there's anybody that would like to testify for or against.
Anyone have questions right now? Yes, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, Representative Hamilton, for bringing this forward with a discussion on the dollars. Now, if I understood what you said correctly, was that this is a new fund, that these are dollars that have not been, prior to this, given any parameters on use. Is that correct?
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there were parameters on the use as far as, but they're pretty broad. And if you read in the statute, and I wish I had it before me, maybe Mr. Sullivan could pull up the statute. The parameters are pretty broad, and in the event there's any dispute at all, we are in the position to change those parameters. And so I believe Chair Poppe, you had an amendment that you shared with us yesterday, I believe it was, that would offer clarification in the event the department or anybody else would have objection to this. But again, it's these are dollars that we're capturing to develop additional programs or investments into rural development type activities.
Representative Petersburg.
Yep. Thank you. I thought that's what I understood, and I know we've heard a lot of testimony here and actual narratives from FFA and others talking about the importance of education and promoting agriculture, and agriculture is still in a transition stage throughout today, as well as future needs of agriculture. So I think it's important for us to always maintain the ability to draw in people, and if this is one way of helping promote that, I think that's certainly worthwhile. Thank you.
Yes. Representative Hamilton, do you have any, you want to?
Well, I'm looking for my glasses, Madam Chair, but it says here, eligible activities include but are not limited to, and that's where, and then it goes on to grants to livestock production and a number of other things, but, you know, that's where I would say that it does offer us quite a bit of leeway in order to address some of these other things, but in the event the department or anybody else would like additional clarification, then you know, we can work that in. We can bring forth legislation to do just that.
All right. I think you may have some people that would want to testify on behalf of the bill, and then we'll see if there's anyone who wants to testify in opposition. And just a reminder, this bill will be passed without recommendations, so we'll be passing it on to the Finance Committee as it will be able to be discussed more fully as far as the financial allocations and where those dollars are going to go for the Agri Fund if there's more discussion on it. But today we wanted to have the policy discussion about the concept and the ideas behind, as Representative Hamilton has already expressed. So I don't know if you have particular people that you want to come down, or if some people are willing to come down and as you do, just welcome to the committee. I know you've been here before. We welcome you back, and if you'll just state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Sandy Ludeman, from Tracy, Minnesota, and I currently serve as the board chairman of Morrow. I was here a little over a month ago and talked to the committee about Morrow, and I'm not going to go over all that again. I guess I would like to step back and look at the broader sense of the bill as one that's been involved in many organizations in rural Minnesota, from being a 4-H leader, FFA parent, FFA member, involved in helping set up AURI some 25-plus years ago. To me, this committee and this legislature has an opportunity to make a statement about the importance of agriculture by supporting these programs across the state. As I worked in economic development and a number of other activities, to me the key is to have energized and informed leaders at all levels. And unfortunately, that is somewhat difficult in some of our rural communities today. And so I think this bill, and I speak in support of it, starting with 4-H and FFA and all the way up through, as Representative Hamilton has indicated, would be a strong message that we feel, that the legislature feels, that agriculture is important to the state. And granted, $2 million is not a big amount of money in the picture, but yet those seed dollars can be very important to specific projects. I've been involved in value-added projects. I was vice chairman of Minnesota Corn Processors, chairman of South Dakota Soy Processors. Without informed and educated leaders, those projects and others like them will struggle. And I think as we look back at the ethanol program, certainly 2021 ethanol plants in the state indicates that those investments years ago have paid big dividends in terms of economic development and jobs across the state. So I would speak in favor of this bill, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions for Mr. Ludeman? I think Representative Nornes had a question.
Not for the testifier.
Not for the testifier, but anyone for Mr. Ludeman? Otherwise, thank you very much for coming before the committee. And Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a comment. I guess that I'm really a firm supporter of all of the phases of agriculture that provide jobs and career opportunities. Where I grew up in rural Minnesota, those were the only jobs available. For a little kid in a little town, there was no other jobs available other than working on a farm. And because of that, I was able to raise money for tuition. So when I went to college, I paid for my tuition in full on the first day because of agriculture. Okay. Question for the chair, mm-hmm. Madam Chair. Can you explain, I guess, to me the difference between passing this and passing it without recommendation?
Passing it without recommendation will mean that we're actually not voting on the merits of the bill. We're passing it along to the Finance Committee for their consideration with regards to the allocation of the dollars.
Madam Chair, what signal does that send to the next committee, if any?
Well, I've spoken with Chair Wagenius, and she understands that the reason why I'm doing this, I want to make sure that there's a level playing field, that these, I know that Representative Anderson has a blender pump bill that's before Chair Wagenius, and I think after this point, if any other bills are introduced, they'll be introduced and go to her committee. They'll be directed there. Again, I'm hoping that since she's serving on this committee, she's aware of kind of the discussion, that we wanted to have the discussion within the ag policy, but that we are passing it along.
Okay. Thank you.
And you have another testifier, so.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, if you will state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, my name is Bob Zelenka. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. Our association represents the grain elevator and feed mill industry here in Minnesota. I'm here to speak in favor of the bill. Our association and me personally are members of the Minnesota Agricultural Interpretive Center, which is called Farm America in short. It's been around since 1978, which was created by the legislature in 1978. And we see a lot of value in ag education. Farm America in this last year had close to 20,000 visitors, primarily students going through the facility. We have the opportunity really with some additional financing to do a lot more in terms of agricultural literacy, agricultural education. So I just wanted to speak in favor of the bill. There's a lot that can be done, I think, with a facility like that, that with the hands-on learning that we can provide at that location. Additional funding like this would certainly be helpful. So just wanted to speak in favor of the bill.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay. Thank you for your presentation. And Representative Faust maybe has a question.
No, it isn't a question, really just a comment. A few years ago, I was visiting with a recruiter from Land O'Lakes, and he told me that they had, I believe it was 126 openings at that point in time for people in feed and agronomy. And he said he covered the states of North Dakota, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. And he said, if you add up all of the people from all of the colleges in those states, it was only like 30 people graduating in those fields. And he had 126 openings that he was supposed to fill. And he said, and we're just one of many companies trying to find the people we need. Now, I think that the reason that this has become such a problem is because so many schools over the years have cut back on their FFA programs and cut back on those types of things. And so I think that the more we can do to encourage those types of things, the better off we are. Because when we've heard the students from FFA talk about how their school was down to, you know, one or two students, and now they're up to 70 or 80. And so I think that we need to do everything we can to promote that in the younger ages and get that going as much as we can. So I think this is a good idea.
Right. Representative Keel, then Representative Anderson. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, Representative Hamilton, do you know how many schools within the metro area, the suburban area, have FFA programs, agriculture programs? It seems to me we've had students testify from there, but
you know,
Representative Hamilton.
Madam Chair, I would not have the direct number or the correct number. However, I have been to a couple of the schools that do are ag related, and it's very impressive right here in the metro area as well. And so there is an interest, and however, I think we can grow that. And you talk to those students that attend the different schools, they're excited about it, and they recognize and see the opportunities. And that would go back to what Representative Faust had said. The more people that we get to understand at that level about the opportunities, we can start filling those positions, and they're great jobs. They're great jobs out there. So to answer your question directly, I don't have that number, and I don't know if there's anybody here that could help me out with it. But the programs that are in place here in the metro area, in my personal opinion and hearing some testimony around that, they're doing remarkably well.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder if Mr. Schoenfeld couldn't relate that. And while he's coming down, I just wanted to make a point that I believe, Representative Faust, these jobs are not minimum wage jobs. They're close and over six-figure jobs, so we need to point our children in those directions because there's a lot of opportunity, especially with our rural, our agriculture background in Minnesota. Thank you.
Mr. Schoenfeld, welcome to the committee. I'll state your name for the record.
Madam Chairman, I'm Jerry Schoenfeld. I work with the Minnesota Association of Ag Educators. In response to the question, there have been a number of schools in the metropolitan area, for instance, in Minneapolis South a few years ago, that wanted to start an ag program and didn't have the availability of it funding-wise. And we've had a number of inquiries from that. The two programs that probably stand out the most in the metropolitan area are, first of all, the MLC helped to create the Urban Ag School a number of years ago, which is a charter school in Van Nuys Heights. It has 300 students, and it has got a very high graduation rate, and all of those students, all 300, come from metropolitan areas. None of them are rural at all. None of them have any agricultural background as such, and those students are 300. The largest FFA and the largest ag program in the state of Minnesota is at Forest Lake. And Forest Lake has got five ag instructors, and I think they have, I believe, I don't want to, for absolute certain, but from memory, I think they have approximately 80% of their student body at Forest Lake takes an ag program and an ag course sometime while they're in high school. And so those are a couple of notables that I would mention.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I do have Representative Anderson, unless this is directly related. Okay. Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to kind of expound on what Representative Faust and Representative Keel mentioned, these programs are not just for farm kids. They're for kids of all over. And I was at a MEOC meeting at the Dassel-Cocato last summer, and they have a great program there. And of the over 100 kids in the program, most of those kids lived in town, or they were on a small acreage. So it isn't just for farm kids. It's for kids from every background. And the Career Tech Ed is just a great way to get the kids to graduate from high school. And as Representative Keel mentioned, the jobs out there, it's a well-known fact that there are jobs out there going wanting because we don't have the people to fill them. So this is a very important area, and I thank Representative Hamilton for bringing this forward.
All right. Representative Clark.
Actually, Representative Johnson.
Representative Johnson.
I got to tell a story about that, though. I've been called Representative Clark frequently, and my Clark is my mother's maiden name, and my grandfather Clark was a good Democrat and would be really proud of me today. So anyway,
Madam Chair, my mom's a Democrat,
but he was an FDR Democrat. So I reflected on that. I kind of enjoyed being called Representative Clark.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you. Madam Chair, my question is for Mr. Schoenfeld.
Oh,
sorry to make you come back, but. Mr. Schoenfeld, for a few years I've heard, I prepare teachers, and so I find myself in schools, and I've heard concerns about declining programs in ag education in south central Minnesota, where most of this, is that valid? Is that what you're seeing, or no?
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Madam Chair, Representative, there are, particularly in south central Minnesota, there have been some declining over the years, but statewide, we've actually picked up a couple of programs over the last couple of years. So the number of programs in the state is fairly level. It's approximately, I believe, about 190 programs right now. And it's fairly level, and we pick up one or two. The biggest problem with maintaining programs, and I think that's true, for instance, down in your area with Le Sueur as an example and some of those towns around there, is that we can't find instructors. The University of Minnesota, I mentioned this head of the committee before, the University of Minnesota has a cap on the number of freshmen that they will allow to come into the Ag Ed program, as they do a cap on a number of others. And so we have been struggling to try and find other ways to maintain people in the ag education arena. And we've done things through MEALC, as an example, that provided for something called PEP program and TIP program. And those are mentoring programs where existing ag instructors work with young ag instructors to try and provide them the support in the first couple of years so that they don't quit the business as such. There's a lot of competition for instructors because agribusiness pays better than education does, and that's one of the big problems. And so it's not the lack of interest, and there have been a number of new programs down in southern Minnesota. I think it's St. Peter even. There was a new program started that there's the interest in it, but there's not always the ability to find an instructor to teach it.
Representative Johnson.
Again, as someone, I prepare teachers in my normal life. Is the University of Minnesota the only university that prepares ag education teachers?
Madam Chair, Representative, it is.
We've tried a number of things. For instance, through the MEALC program, we did create something called 2 plus 2, which provides for the first 2 years to be at a community college, as an example, like South Central and Mankato, and then the last 2 years to be able to be completed at the University of Minnesota, but it is the only institution in the state that provides a degree in agricultural education.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Schoenfeld, is it limited to the university because of the need to take ag-related courses that would only be offered through the university?
Mr. Schoenfeld?
Madam Chair, I believe that the history of that would be a fair statement, that as ag education developed in the state, it was centered at the University of Minnesota because of the College of Agriculture and the ability to do that. For about 90 years, the ag ed program or ag ed degree was granted by two different colleges within the University of Minnesota. The College of Agriculture had half of it, and the College of Education over on the Minneapolis campus had the other half. 2 years ago, that changed. It took 90 years to do, but now all of the ag education is under the College of Agriculture. And so it is no longer under the College of Education. But initially, that was the case, that the ag programs. And as you probably know, within the MinsU system, there are additional places, but they are almost all two-year programs. For instance, Riverland, I believe we're represent Poppy mm-hmm. works, or South Central in Mankato, but they are two-year programs for the most part. So by doing the 2+2 system, we were able to increase the number of students by giving some of those agricultural courses in the community colleges that provided them, and then transferred to the University of Minnesota. But that is the final place. The other places that most of the ag educators come from are River Falls in Wisconsin, which has got a very large program, and South Dakota and North Dakota.
All right, Representative Johnson.
One last question, Madam Chair, Mr. Schoenfeld. Have any of the MinsU institutions shown any interest in having, picking up or being able to and interest to pick up the demand?
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Madam Chair, Representative, we very recently, and I'm talking in the last 2 months, I believe it's Vice Chancellor Knowlton from MinsU has had a couple of meetings with the Commissioner of Agriculture regarding that opportunity within MinsU. Nothing has been done on it, but they have had some brief discussions.
All right, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We did have ag education instructors at the University of Minnesota Crookston, and through reductions it was lost 2 years ago, I believe. There is a new chancellor there, and he and I have been actively talking about it, and he is requesting that they not throw it entirely out of the window. But what's happening to any students that want to be in agriculture education in my area that don't desire to go to this Minneapolis area, or like Mr. Schoenfeld said, they're heading to North Dakota State University. South Dakota State University is where they're heading. So, and there's a problem with them coming back to teach in Minnesota if they so choose. There's some requirements that are not aligned. So that is part of our problem. We had a small group, I believe, in University of Minnesota Crookston, about 4 or 6 students, and that's basically why it was moved out. The one extension I was going to share was that a University of Minnesota instructor up in Crookston campus has tried to get more FFA programs started in our districts, and what we have done because of the financial issues are to have an instructor. He or she is very busy. They have 4 different schools. They do all of the instruction online except for one day she spends one each day in the school. So she has 4 schools. Every day she's in a different school except for one day where she is in her office to be able to do different work. But they do all of that instruction that way. And it's worked real well in our very rural schools where there's small amounts of students. And then they do FFA projects jointly that way, and then they can have an FFA program along with ag instruction. So it was to try and get it started again, because my district is very rural, and yet we don't have very much ag education at all up there. So thank you.
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Madam Chair, I just think I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this as well. As I said, I work with the Minnesota Association of Ag Educators, but one other part of that, in partial response to your question, is that in addition to the high school instructors, as an example, there are 57 farm business management instructors in the state as well that work with about 2,500 adult farmers. And those that has been declining at a much more rapid rate than the high schools. In the year 2000, we had 105 instructors. We're down to 57. That's in large part because MNSCU, there is a deficit in that because it's a very high-cost program. And so for the Minnesota Association of Ag Educators, that is their highest priority for the session to try and help do something about farm business management.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Mr. Schoenfeld, could you mentioned talking about the ag education class at the university. There's also a cap on the number of students that they have in the program. And as I recall, does that number even come close to satisfying the demand for ag teachers in our Minnesota schools?
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Madam Chair, it does not. We are, as I indicated before, we have a number of openings that are left open each year. That doesn't mean that the number of schools have declined. The number of schools have stayed fairly static, but we have demand for more. And that's where programs particularly would like to start new programs or whatever, and so that's one of the issues.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At the risk of prolonging this conversation, I know we've got additional bills to go forward. I'll just say that, you know, the real issue here is that we've got real dollars in terms of inflation adjusted going into higher education at 1980-81 levels. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, if you really want to address the real root of the issue, so once again, we have to have an honest conversation about how do we raise revenue in the state and how do we pay for things.
Any other questions for Representative Hamilton and this bill? Thank you, Mr. Schoenfeld. And anyone who wants to speak additionally on the bill? Otherwise, I think Representative Hamilton will renew his motion.
I'll renew that, and I ask for your support.
All right. So it will be passed along to the Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you for the discussion, Representative Hamilton. We do have some minutes that we should get through, and we're going to bring down we're going to do the honeybee habitat bill next, but in the meantime, Representative Erickson. Would you?
I would be happy to move the minutes of March 6th, 2013, March 7th, 2013, and March 13th, 2013.
Thank you. Any discussion? Otherwise, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And just... as an introduction here, we are going to go now to House File 595. And this is a bill that actually I'm authoring. Representative Torkelson is the second author and the kind of the person who brought the awareness about this issue forward. And so he's going to sit at the table and help to introduce the presenters regarding this bill. But I think... Do you want to talk about the bill as introduced? Do you want to do an amendment first? I'm going to leave that up to you, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. First, thank you for bringing this bill to the committee today, and thank you for being the chief author of the bill, and thanks for allowing me to kind of save you the trip up here to the testifiers table. I think I would prefer that we adopt the A1 amendment.
A1.
And if you are okay with that, I would also identify a typo in the amendment on line 1.14. Instead of including, it should say include. Oh.
We have.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize it.
We have not yet.
Okay, well, that's being passed out. I'll just give a brief background on the bill. As most of you know or probably have heard, pollinators, including bees, are having problems all across the country. Bee health, hive health, has been an issue for quite some time, and it's really, we're working on it, but we don't have all the solutions. And part of the issue is that to stay healthy, a beehive and the bees in it need good food, basically. They need the stuff that they need to eat to produce honey and to stay alive and stay healthy. The bee industry in Minnesota is important not only to the state of Minnesota, but to other industries all across this country. My former constituent really is the instigator of this bill. He's a beekeeper who is currently in Texas with his bees right now. They're down there pollinating something. I'm not even sure what. But he was such a pest that I actually moved out of his district so he would leave me alone. But he still pesters me anyway. So he's actually a good man and is very interested in helping his industry to thrive and survive. And that's really what this bill is all about. Now that you have the A1 in front of you, I would again highlight on line 1.4 that it should say include instead of including, so that the additional language then makes some sense. If you would care to adopt that amendment.
Yes, Representative Torkelson, I move that the H0595A1 amendment be adopted. Any discussion? Otherwise, all in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. That amendment's adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think at this point it would really be good if we had someone who knows a lot more about this than I do speak briefly to the bill. We have Ms. Spivak from the University of Minnesota here, and she knows a lot more about bees than I ever will, so I'd be happy to have her give her background on the bill, and then she will stand for questions.
That would be very good. If you would please just state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Marla Spivak, and I'm at the University of Minnesota. I do research on bees. I speak on behalf of all bees, honeybees, and our wild bees, and on behalf of beekeepers in Minnesota. So I'm so proud that this is even here. Thanks for so much for considering this bill. This is very good. So this is something that would put habitat on the ground for our honeybees and our wild bees. They're such in need of good nutrition. They just need flowers on the ground. So we're working on many fronts to ensure that they have good, clean food resources, which are flowers for bees. So this would be one area where we could increase that. And any flowers that we put in would be good for both honeybees and wild bees. Our beekeepers are in dire need. This has been a bad winter for them. The numbers are not in, but in previous years, beekeepers nationwide have taken on average 30% loss of their honeybee colonies every winter. This winter, when the numbers come in, I think they'll be well over 40%. This has been a bad winter, and many of our beekeepers in Minnesota are hurting. So when they come back home with their bees, most of them are migratory beekeepers, when they come back home for their bees, it'd be nice to be able to tell them that in future years we're working toward getting more habitat on the ground. Honey production in Minnesota, even since I've been here, since 20 years, average honey yields in Minnesota in 1993 were about 100, 120 pounds per colony, and now it's 60 pounds per colony, and that's due to lack of flowers.
All right, thank you. Just to talk about the bill a little bit, the House File 595, originally the bill was expecting that the Commissioner of Natural Resources would develop the habitat. This amendment actually says that they need to establish the criteria for that later development. And I think we're trying to accommodate as quickly as possible what the need is, but also making sure that we can move this along and hopefully get some action taken. Representative Wagenius.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm so glad that you're here, and I don't know if folks know what a resource we have sitting at this table. I really appreciate your being here. For the honeybee, not the native pollinators, but the honeybees, I don't know how far they travel for their food, and I'm just thinking when we establish spots and somebody brings their bees in, how far do we have to think about their traveling and back?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Wagenius, honeybees travel on average about two and a half miles.
every foraging trip. So they leave their colony, they forage over about 8,000 acres and then come back home. Wild bees travel less than half a mile generally.
Representative Wagenius.
The reason I was thinking about this is at our farm we've had Steve Ellis, mm-hmm. who is a beekeeper in this state, has hives at our farm. And he hasn't been there forever, but I can't remember a time when there wasn't somebody right. there. But the thing that I think is important for us is, or for him, is that he can come easily off Highway 27 and without much, has a great place to park and has a very protected area. So nobody can see his hives from, nobody can see his hives. You have to know that they're there. So it does seem to me that there, when you talk about criteria for it, I really appreciate that language coming in. But I also think it is going to, we're going to have to go beyond criteria because it does seem to me that we're going to have to find likely spots that are useful. Is that, am I thinking in the right direction
here? Dr. Spivak.
Madam Chair. I think I need to clarify something. I think this is about flowers in the ground, and I'm not sure, but I think you're asking where are the beekeepers going to put their bees? Do they need to put their bees on these conservation easements?
Right.
And I don't think that, I'm not sure. I guess I would pose the question to you. That's not how I read it. I thought they'd be keeping their bees in other spots, and the bees would be able to fly to these easements.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. But then that would tell me that we would need to know where the beekeepers are, or DNR would need to know where the beekeepers are, so that we had some coordination here, and that's what I'm just trying to think through. I don't have anything particularly in mind. I'm just trying to understand it.
Dr. Spivak.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Beekeepers are everywhere in this state, except for they've thinned out a lot in the Southwest because of the abundance of corn and soybeans in that area and the lack of honey plants. And they're not up in the big forested areas, so the boundary waters are northeast. But the big swath all the way from the southeast to the northwest, all through the central region of Minnesota, there are beekeepers and lots of them. And when they know that there's flowers, they'll move their bees into new locations to be near them. So I'm not so worried about that. The beekeepers will find the flowers.
Yes, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And it was really my intention in bringing this issue forward that it be a bit of a wake-up call for the DNR, and that they would then reach out to the beekeepers and work with them to identify where best to do this work and where it would be most beneficial for the bees in Minnesota. And it's kind of silly not to, and I would hope they would do it in that fashion.
Representative Wagenius.
There is another possibility here, too, that I'm just thinking about, and as long as we're just thinking out loud here, as we give money to farmers for buffer strips, we have been at times requiring native species, which would, and if you have a lot of forbs, that would be giving you the flowering across the season, which I think is what we're after here, if I'm getting it right. We could be, since we're funding that anyway, that might be something for us to have folks think about as they are doing these plantings. Would that be something that would be helpful?
Dr. Spivak?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, any farm buffer strips, hedgerows around cropland is extremely useful. It has to be done wisely when you're planting flowers. You don't want to attract pests for the crop that they're near. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of studies going on this nationwide. If you're going to put in hedgerows around crops, then what are the best? Which ones would bring in beneficial insects that might provide pest control in your crop and provide habitat for bees and nesting sites for the wild bees? So there's lots of opportunity And it's just a lot of discussion needs to happen, as it says here, about consultation and recommendations for what kinds of flowers and where and how to do it correctly.
Okay.
I hope that answered your question.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Spivak. I heard you speak here a year or two ago, and it was very, very inspiring and informative as well. And I thank you for all the research that you do on this issue. And a point of clarification, I guess, to the authors is, it's not the intent, is it, to allow the state to then get in the business of selling honey and compete with private businesses at all, and similar to the nursery programs that we addressed here.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hamilton, surely not. This is all about habitat and flowers. It's not about going into the honey business for the state of Minnesota, although maybe we need an official sweetener for the state. And honey would be a good one.
That would do it.
All right. And Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Torkelson for bringing this forward, and Professor Spavak for being here. I don't think people realize how important honeybees are to the food supply of this country, and what would happen to the food supply of this country if the honeybees just disappeared, because they're so critical in pollinating so many of the crops and so much of the food that we eat, that it's just critical that the honeybees are able to maintain their habitat. And a few years ago, then Representative Kate Knuth was planning to go out to North Dakota and study honeybees, I think around the Jamestown area, and to try to figure out why the honeybee hives at times just left the hive and figure out what was happening to them. And so I don't know if you were the one that she was working with, maybe. I don't even know. But I'm just, I guess, curious if you can, in, you know, 30 seconds or a minute or less, tell us what that research is showing.
Dr. Spivak.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I have a grant from the USDA to study the impact of different landscapes on honeybees and on wild or native bee pollinators. And how it ended up in North Dakota is a long story, doesn't fit in 30 seconds. two students, graduate students, are working on this. Kate Knuth went out with us several times in great interest on this. Basically, we can show for honeybees, we're beginning to show, the research is not complete yet, that we can predict based, we're developing a blood test for a honeybee colony, basically. You know, we go to the doctor, they test our cholesterol, they say you better change your diet or whatever. We can take a sample of bees and analyze certain components within their blood and their immune system to determine how that influences colony health and the environment that they're in, meaning the flowers that are around them, and how the landscape affects the abundance and diversity of our native bees. North Dakota's being encroached with all their CRP land, not all, a lot of their CRP land is being turned over into corn and soybeans, and it's having a dramatic effect on all the bee population.
All right, and Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Professor Spivak, just if you could clarify, are honeybees native to here?
Dr. Spivak.
Madam Chair. Honeybees are not native to the United States. They're all introduced from Europe. They were introduced when we colonized the New World. They were brought over into North and South America. We have 4,000 species of native bees here in the U.S., probably around 400 or so in Minnesota. Many of our bumblebees, which are native, are endangered worse than honeybees. But we need all the pollinators. Honeybees are one of the major pollinators of our food crops. Wild bees also contribute greatly to the pollination of our food crops.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Representative Paul.
Appreciate the clarification. And just looking through parts of the bill, and I see some of the sections are deleted, but maybe the question I have is, should we be looking at introducing non-native species for food stock when we're trying to, you know, spend as much time restoring native species? And are those two, I'm assuming they're probably not mutually exclusive. You could probably have non-native honeybees and still retain native flowering plants and make the system work.
Dr. Spivak.
Thank you, Representative Paul. Yes, that's the crux of the issue. That's where the recommendations come in. So, you know, you want to make sure the honeybee keepers want clover, alfalfa, and buckwheat on the ground and basswood trees. DNR would prefer native plants, many of the native prairie plants, but both of those are compatible among all the bees. So honeybees feed on many of our native forbs. Our native wild bees feed on clover, alfalfa, and buckwheat. So it just depends on where it is and what's appropriate for that area, what's put in. So if you're restoring a native prairie, you don't want to put in non-native plants, as it specifies in here. And, you know, there's just locations where different combinations of plants would be beneficial and useful.
Just want to note, we've amended the bill, but I don't believe I've actually moved the bill. So I'm going to move the bill, House File 595, as amended, and recommend that it be re-referred to the Finance Committee. So I just want to, the bill is before us, and we are having the discussion. But Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to ask about that. I did learn something brand new today. I learned that another non-native advocacy group that advocates for another non-native species, that'd be the pheasant. Pheasants Forever now has a, within its group, has a group called Pollinators Forever. They understand just how valuable this kind of habitat is, not only to their non-native species, the pheasants, but also to other non-native species, which might include honeybees.
Okay, and Representative Quisha.
Representative, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Torkelson, I can't resist, but you're not saying pheasants pollinate, are you?
No, I'm okay. Not. But but they like to eat insects, and insects thrive in this kind of habitat.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, Representative Torkelson. It's a good bill. Just a clarification. On page one, we're talking about the Commissioner of Natural Resources. And then on page two, like line 2.14, talking about the board shall develop a list of plantings. So what board are we talking about?
Representative Torkelson, do you want to take that, or should I ask Mr. Sullivan to answer that?
I had not noticed that, Madam Chair. Or there may be a
typographical I believe it's the Board of Soil and Water that's being referred to there. So it's kind of a two-part bill.
Okay.
Representative Anderson.
And then just one last thing. This is a very important situation with our bees disappearing as fast as they are. Is there any kind of a timeline on your bill that would have this list developed by such and such a time and to get moving on this?
Representative Torkelson.
Wasn't there a date in there for the criteria?
Actually, we do not have a date in this amendment.
Well, you're right. It was in the other. And I'd be happy if would you... We can amend this in the next committee, would be my suggestion.
Do you have further questions? I think we were looking at trying to come up with a way to move this along, and so we were working on a couple of different amendments. And one, we were having a report that was going to be drafted and given to us, and this one did not have that. But I think the language is what we wanted to... I think it reflects what our intention is at this point. Other questions about this bill or to direct it to our testifier, or if there's anyone in the audience who wants to speak on behalf of or in opposition to this? Yes, Representative Wagenius.
I'm not in opposition at all. I truly believe we ought to do something. What I'm trying to figure out is how or who would be good at setting up this criteria, because I don't think that DNR has that expertise. That's my instinct. I may be wrong about that. I wonder if we shouldn't be thinking through, we don't have to do it now, but thinking through a group to ask them to help us do this. That's what I'm thinking about. It's not that I don't think we should do it, but I think we are missing this step of this group to tell us, give us some guidance, because I've never heard of this expertise in DNR. I've never even heard them talk about native pollinators, which is a problem. That's my worry.
Okay. Representative Torkelson, or?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be happy to work with the author of the bill and the chair of the next committee to enhance this bill as we move forward through the process.
I think Dr. Spivak, do you have comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The DNR is quite good at plant selection lists for native plants and native prairie. I'm more than happy to offer my services on behalf of the beekeepers and to come up with some plant lists that would be good for all.
All right.
I'm more than happy to do that.
Wonderful. Thank you for raising that question, Representative Wagenius. Other questions related to this bill? Otherwise, I will again move this bill, House File 595, as amended, to the Environment, Natural Resources, and Ag Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and thank you for your testimony today. We very much appreciate it. Thank you, Representative Torkelson. We will now go to House File 757, and Representative Wills. Representative Wills, welcome to the committee. You have House File 757. And I believe this bill next would go to environment policy, perhaps. Is that where it's?
Madam Chair, that was a question we had. Unfortunately, the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Omnibus Bill has already been completed. So my hope was that this would be able to bypass that committee and go to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Committee to be considered for inclusion in that bill, if it would be acceptable.
Representative Dill is out of the room at the moment, and it would be his committee that we would be bypassing. So I'd want his impression of that.
I would hope for that as well.
Maybe we can hear that all when we decide.
We'll go ahead and get started, and then we'll and you also had an amendment, I believe. Is that?
I do, Madam Chair. There is an author's amendment to just change some technical corrections and to remove a sentence from the end of the bill. So I will move that amendment. I should have somebody else move it, because I'm not part of the committee.
Actually, thank you. And Representative Dill, we are having a discussion now about House File 757. The path for this bill would include going to Environment and Natural Resources Policy. The author is requesting that we amend the bill here, and that we send the bill as amended on to the Environment and Natural Resources Ag Finance Committee, bypassing your committee. And so I'm seeking your advice on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, I came to hear the bill. Even though I signed on the bill, I wanted to hear the bill. I was hoping that we could pass it to Finance. But after when the testimony is over, then I'm going to advise the chair how I feel about it.
All right. So we have the bill before us. I'm going to move at this point that the bill will be heard and sent to Environment Policy, and we will amend that if we need to. But that way we've got the bill before us, and you have the author's amendment, which I believe everyone has now, and that's the A1. And so now I'll move the A1 amendment. And all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, no. Motion prevails. It is now in the shape that the author would request it to be. So if you can go ahead, Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill essentially allows the Minnesota Zoo to be able to take moose out of the wild. Currently, it is against the law. And with the dwindling moose population, the Minnesota Zoo has been working on a conservation program to research why this is happening and bring back our population and to bring moose, which is an iconic species of the state of Minnesota, and why I have the picture here today. Sorry that it's a little out of focus. And so they've asked me to carry this bill because the Minnesota Zoo is also in my district. So I wanted to support their efforts. And with me today I have Dr. Paul Anderson, and he can give some more of the background of why this change is needed.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Paul Anderson. I'm an assistant director with the Board of Animal Health.
Thank you. And then if you just go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, we've been working with the people at the Minnesota Zoo for about 6 years now to try to identify a way that we could safely bring specifically moose is with where this started. Moose, they have talked about bringing moose from Alaska. These orphan fawn or these orphan calf moose into the state, and until now we've not had a mechanism to do this because of the farm survey laws on chronic wasting disease, tuberculosis, brucellosis, and other diseases. And we certainly are in support of this bill. I think that we've now found a way that we can, with very minimal risk, bring these animals into specifically the Minnesota Zoo. I think the reason that this, and the folks that have been in on this conversation, we certainly worked with the Department of Natural Resources, with the deer breeders, the elk breeders, the deer hunters, the people from the University of Minnesota, and all of us are in agreement that this would be a safe way to bring these types of animals to the zoo. Part of it also works because of the isolation facilities the zoo has, where the biosecurity there is very strong and there is minimal risk that there would ever be exposure to other farmed animals or to wild animals at the zoo. And so the folks at the zoo actually came up with this proposal. We met with all the interested parties, and we've discussed this at great length. And I think we're all in agreement that this will work, that it's a safe way to bring in these animals. Moose are certainly the one animal that kind of got this going. But we've also talked to the zoo about bringing in pudu and some of these very small cervidae from Argentina and Peru, where chronic wasting disease is not known to exist. And so there may be some other animals that would also, that they would benefit with bringing in other species as well.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius has a question.
I do. So the proposal is to bring them to our zoo in Apple Valley?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair?
Yes.
And
ahead,
Representative, that would be the proposal, is specifically to bring these to the Minnesota Zoo in Apple Valley.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't live very far from here, and I can tell you that with the change in climate, we are now in an agricultural zone 5 instead of an agricultural zone 4, and I think would be bringing these animals from a zone that would be like 1 or 2 in my district. In the summertime, it gets really hot. And I'm trying to figure out how we could bring animals that are used to really cold into a climate that, I don't want to say this for sure, but I planted a peach tree in my backyard last year in the cities. I don't know whether it survived the winter or not, but it is a zone 5 tree, and I just thought I'd try. But it's one thing to lose a peach tree. It would be another thing to lose a moose.
Dr. Anderson.
Madam Chair and representatives, you know, I'm certainly not the moose expert. Our folks at the zoo know a lot more about moose than I do. But they seem confident that the environment would be appropriate for these animals, is what I've been told.
Representative Wills.
And in addition to that, we do have moose at the Minnesota Zoo currently. So they've been known to survive just fine so far. And I can understand the concern of bringing them out of a different climate. But it does get hot in northern Minnesota as well in the summer. So I don't know how serious the concern would be. I guess I'm just not familiar with the difference.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. We're not bringing them down from northern Minnesota. We're bringing them from Alaska, as I understood.
Madam Chair. Dr. Anderson.
Representative, that's my understanding, is that there are these moose that would be available from Alaska. I'm not sure about the climate. I really can't comment on that.
Well, I know that the climate in Alaska and in South Minneapolis and Apple Valley are very, very different. I think that's intuitive.
Representative Dill.
Thank you. So about the temperature thing, it's not very often Representative Lagunias and I are on the temperature on the global warming side of the curve, but together. But in the studies, in the study area in northeastern Minnesota, where the moose herd has gone from 8,800 in 2006 down to 2,500 or so in 13, the vast majority of the moose now are over on the Grand Portage Indian Reservation. And I wondered why that happened. And the DNR told me that the reason that's happening is because the prevailing winds off of Lake Superior cool that area like you would have snow, the snow that you have because the wind, can't think of the name of it now, but anyway, lake effect snow, you got lake effect wind, and they migrate over there to stay cool. The other question I had was this, what, you already have moose there, and where are they from?
Representative Wills, or...
Madam Chair.
Dr. Anderson.
We have been to the zoo. We've, you know, certainly looked at the moose exhibit, and there are a few moose at the zoo. The need from the zoo, from what we've been told, is that they really need to, two things. They need to bring in more moose, but they need to broaden the genetic base of that herd as well. So they'd like to bring in some animals from outside of the zoo. You know, I think that, so there's a couple reasons why they want to bring these moose in from other areas.
Representative Dill.
Okay, so, well, the moose that we have in Minnesota, the ones that I thought that you'd want in the zoo, are vastly different than the moose in Saskatchewan, and vastly different than in Manitoba and Alaska and the Yukon and even BC or Newfoundland or Quebec. There are many different things, and so are you saying now that, well, first off, I think that it does have to go to environment policy. So I think that the thing is right. I don't want to be a killjoy here, but what we'll do is we'll have a hearing on it as soon as we can, and if everything is right, we will. I will ask the leadership to take this to rules and send it through rules, and we'll get it over to Representative Lagunias, and we'll just see how that plays out. But so now, did I hear you say that we're going to change the gene pool between moose? Did I hear that's what you said?
Dr. Anderson.
Madam Chair and representatives, I shouldn't speak for the folks at the zoo because, you know, we certainly know what we've been told by them, but where the Board of Animal Health, our part was to make sure that we had minimal risk of bringing diseases into the state like chronic wasting disease. And that's really the role that we've played, and I think that we've found a way with minimal risk to bring these animals in. The way this bill is written, certainly the Board of Animal Health and the Department of Natural Resources would have to weigh in on whether we thought the origin of these animals was safe for these kinds of diseases. And that's really where my expertise is, rather than on the herd itself.
Mr. Appetz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Appetz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer, and we represent the Minnesota Zoo here at the legislature. Apologies that Mr. Emke couldn't be here today. There was a conflict that he ran into. If I could just answer a couple of questions real quickly to Madam Chair, to Representative Lagunias' first question. The primary concern of the zoo is the health and safety of its animals. We are not going to bring animals in here that can't survive and be sustained in Minnesota, regardless of where they come from. The exception here that we're talking about is for cervidae. We're talking about moose, but cervidae, I think, as everybody here knows, are a variety of different creatures. They talk about moose, elk, deer, reindeer, that type of animal. And some of those are, for instance, I believe it's our elk herd that is getting so old that the possibility of breeding any longer isn't a very real possibility. And if you're going to replenish that herd, what you need to do is bring in other cervidae, other elk. We can't do that. We cannot bring in elk from the wild because of the restrictions in place at the Board of Animal Health and at the DNR. So we spent the last several years trying to figure out how to do this. The resolution was the bill that you see before you. It's exclusive to the Minnesota Zoo. What it does is provide the Minnesota Zoo the exception that it needs, not from the Board of Animal Health rules, so that it doesn't open up the Board of Animal Health statute. It provides only for the Minnesota Zoo statute. So it is exclusive to the Minnesota Zoo. To the question about genetics, the issue with genetics is one about expanding the pool of genetics when you have a decreasing number of animals who can be bred together. What you don't want is too much inbreeding for obvious reasons, and what we want to do is bring in other sorts of animals, not other sorts, but other animals that are able to replenish the populations from time to time at the Minnesota Zoo. The orphaned moose up in Alaska are one set of moose that are available to us and that we could bring in here if we're able to overcome this particular reservation. There are other types of cervidae that would be involved in this as well. So I don't know if I covered all the questions, but rest assured we're not going to be bringing any animals into the zoo that would be jeopardized by their presence here.
Representative Dill.
Is there a reason why the Alaska, Madam Chair, and Mr. Appice, is there a reason why you're bringing in the Alaskan moose? Why wouldn't you go up to the Wabakimi Park, by the way, where I have a moose hunting operation, and we got lots of moose, and there's a lot of orphan calves that are at the exact same herd, except it's vastly populated versus what we have in Minnesota. And why wouldn't you go up there and get an abandoned calf? Arnold Beebe, I bet, the head of the Ontario Moose Bear Program, would just love to do something like that. Maybe I'm totally wrong. But why wouldn't you get a moose of like? That's a real biological question, I suppose.
Mr. Appitz?
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, that's a little bit beyond my scope. But these are moose that are available, because they're in Alaska, they're orphan moose that are available. I don't suspect that anybody at the legislature wants us. I'm sorry, I don't know where the park is that you're referencing. Okay. Are we in Minnesota?
Yeah.
Did you talk? Okay, forgive me. The assumption is that we don't want to be taking a limited number of moose out of the already existing population and putting them into the zoo.
Representative Dill.
Well, no, the Wabakimi Park is 250 miles north of Thunder Bay. And that's the same moose, exactly. They came, but anyway, for those of on the committee, I mean, an Alaskan moose up in the on the North Slope has a 70-inch rack, and they weigh anywhere from 12 to 1,500 pounds. The bulls, the same moose in northeastern Minnesota, or in that same strain of herd up into Canada. A large one might weigh 1,000 pounds and only have a 55 ones and only have a 55 inch rack, possibly a 60. I mean, occasionally we take 60 inch racks. It's not that often. So I mean, there's something really different about, and I don't see a problem with, since we don't have the resources here to answer the questions. It's not anybody's fault. When I start hearing about genetics and putting the genetics together, it just kind of throws a red flag up. And I'm not against the bill. I'm an author of the bill. But it's going somewhere where I didn't anticipate it to, and so we'll have to move forward.
All right. Representative Keel. Oops, she's not here. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question, when we're talking about additional genetics and that whole scope, I was wondering if you've ever thought about, or if you could do, whether it's embryo transplants or introducing semen versus live animals through artificial insemination. We do that a lot in the livestock industry so that you do have disease reduction. And then you can do PCR testing or whatever the case may be. So I was just wondering if that's an issue, if that's an option.
Mr. Appetz?
Madam Chair, certainly it is. And with other breeds of animals, we do that. Tigers, others, we are the world's repository for tigers. They're the tiger breeding program worldwide. And you need to keep track of the genetics and move them about, and that's one of the ways that it's done. So, absolutely, it's a technique that's used quite frequently.
Representative Hamilton, okay. Representative Cresha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for this the opportunity to talk about this. And maybe with the moose expert not being here, maybe this won't be an easy answerable question, but you say you figured out how to get them there safely now, and it's been about 6 years. I'm curious, was it a transport issue? What were some of the obstacles that you had to overcome to get to the solution?
Madam Chair, I'll let
Dr. Anderson.
But essentially, it was a legal issue. It's a statutory issue. It wasn't about the transport.
Dr. Anderson.
Madam Chair and committee members, from the Board of Animal Health standpoint, chronic wasting disease was probably the issue that was holding us up over these years, and certainly no one wants to bring chronic wasting disease into the state of Minnesota in a wild animal or in farmed animals. And so, you know, from our standpoint, we always said that our rules prohibit this unless they can come from a herd that has 5 years of testing and that sort of thing. And this vehicle, really what this allowed us to do is take a look at wild animals, not farmed animals, but wild animals, and assess the area that they come from, talking with the DNR and the zoo and us and others, to assess the risk of bringing an animal from an area. Now, Alaska is a fairly CWD-free area. They've had CWD in a couple of farmed herds there, but not in the wild that I'm aware of. And so I think that was where some of those animals were targeted. But certainly from the Board of Animal Health standpoint, we didn't want to create a situation that would bring diseases into the state. And I think that this language would allow us at least a path where we could consider bringing wild animals to the zoo, and it could be cervidae, it could be pigs for that matter, if they came from the right part of the world or the right areas. But we certainly don't want to risk our wildlife or our farmed animals with importing such animals into the state.
Representative Cresha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, because that's exactly what my next follow-up was going to be, was the CWD. So just to be absolutely clear, you believe, you're confident that you've overcome the risk of bringing the CWD down.
Dr. Anderson.
Madam Chair and representatives, we think for two reasons that this will work. One of them is, you know, certainly we will consult the wildlife experts and we'll talk to the folks in the source countries or states where the zoo requests to bring an animal in. The other thing that makes it work, though, is the way the zoo is actually constructed, where there's very good biosecurity, and these small herds are isolated by double and often triple fences at, you know, great lengths apart. I live in Apple Valley, and I know there's a lot of white-tailed deer in Apple Valley as well, and we certainly don't want to expose that population, but we've looked at the zoo, the way these things are set up, and we really think that if the worst case happened and an animal came to the zoo that had one of these diseases, that it would not expose our wildlife or our other farmed animals.
All right, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just have a question on the language of the bill. On line 1.10, it says the board must request a permit, but then we have deleted lines 13 and 14 that says they have to issue a permit. So do they need a permit or not?
Representative Wills.
Thank you for that question. The reason why that was changed was because in the case that a permit would be requested, this allows the opportunity for the zoo to request that permit. So if you read it, it says, the board must request a permit from the Board of Animal Health for any exemption from the provisions of Chapter 35, and so on. So if they want an exemption, they must request a permit for it, which currently they couldn't even request a permit. The reason we removed the language at the end was so that the Board of Animal Health and the Department of Natural Resources can decide whether or not they want to issue that permit. They still have the authority to say no.
Representative Anderson? Okay. Representative Dill?
So if the Alaska moose come down here and we end up with Alaska Minnesota moose, then I just have a question. Do we have to have GMO labeling on the moose? Then?
Any other questions?
GMO.
All right. Otherwise, we do have House File 757 as amended, recommended to pass, be re-referred to the Environment Natural Resources Policy Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay.
Nay.
The motion prevails. The bill is passed. And we just next week we'll meet if we have bills before us, but we don't know at this point that we will have any. And so for those of you that didn't get to a legislative report this year, either we'll do it sometime yet and have if we would were to have another meeting. Otherwise, you might be off the hook until next session. So just wanted to you to know that. Yes, Representative Anderson.
I have a blender pump bill.
Thank you all for being such a good committee, and if I don't see you in committee next week, then thank you, and thank you, Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Meeting adjourned.